I'm gone. And you won't find me singing on this song when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it. I guess I'll have to do it. Guess I'll have to do it while I'm here.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the March 5th, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM radio and webcast worldwide at weft.org. And the views and opinions stated during this hour of programming are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WEFT's management, board of directors, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Tom with acknowledgement of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is being brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, I'm your host, Bob Pelesny, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us later in the show. He'll have the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's poem for this week will be March by the Millions from his book Cries for Justice. And also with us here today is Jason Kozlowski, another co-host. He'll also have some labor news, some commentary, and some labor history for us. And also here today is a co-founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, Bill Gorell, and he'll be here with some additional commentary. So now here's Tom to kick off this week's edition with Workers' Interest News.
The United States has approved the first deep-water drilling permit in the Gulf of Mexico since British Petroleum's massive oil spill. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement announced last week that it had issued a permit to Noble Energy Incorporated to continue work on its Santiago well about 70 miles southeast of Venice, Louisiana. Drilling will resume nearly 1 year after BP's blowout created the worst offshore oil spill in U.S. history. Noble had actually started drilling the Santiago well just 4 days before the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded on April 20th of 2010, and their project was put on hold June 12, 2010, after the government placed a moratorium on exploration in waters deeper than 500 feet. No other new deepwater permits had been issued since the moratorium had been lifted in October of 2010. Regulators have been under pressure from the oil industry, as well as some lawmakers, to get drilling projects started again in the Gulf while ensuring that new safeguards are in place. The pressure increased last week as the price of oil jumped above $100 a barrel and the price of gasoline climbed to its highest level in 2.5 years at almost $4 a gallon. Jason?
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker of the Tea Party / Republican Party's efforts to strip public employee unions of most of their collective bargaining rights appears to be so unpopular that even a Rasmussen poll now finds that almost 60% of likely Wisconsin voters disapprove of his job performance. That finding shows just how quickly Walker, who was elected to his first term last November with 52% of the vote, has sunk just in his first 2 months in office, and it comes one day after Rasmussen released results from the same poll, all of which showed public opinion firmly on the side of the unions in the labor rights battle that has deadlocked the state capitol for the past few weeks. In the poll, 57% of respondents said they disapprove of Walker's job performance, including 48% who say they strongly disapprove. Meanwhile, only 43% said they approve of the job Walker is doing. Not surprisingly, respondents who said they belong to a public union sided heavily against Walker, with roughly 8 in 10 giving him negative marks on job performance. Yet not only were public sector union members opposed to Walker, but a majority of private sector union members also disapprove of the governor by a 53 to 43% margin. Also interesting to note, the overwhelming opposition from people with children in Wisconsin public schools. 67% of people in that demographic disapprove of Walker, including 54% who strongly disapprove. It's the latest poll to show Walker losing public support as the debate drags on and as he continues to insist on a rollback of collective bargaining rights that have been in place for decades. Previous polls have shown that Walker receiving little support for his proposal. The Rasmussen poll is notable because, while others are typically Democratic or neutral pollsters, Rasmussen tends to tilt Republican, suggesting the results spell even more trouble for Walker. Bob?
All right. Thanks, Jason. I got a story here from Labor Notes, and it says, more than 1,000 nurses at Kaiser Permanente's Los Angeles Medical Center walked off the job Wednesday over staffing levels they say threaten patient care. The nurses, they're members of the National Union of Healthcare Workers, say Kaiser is stalling contract talks and refusing to improve nurse-to-patient ratios. California became the first and so far only state to mandate specific nurse-to-patient ratios, which took effect in 2004. Research has shown the ratios have kept more patients alive, lowered the frequency of preventable complications, and decreased the number of nurses who burn out and leave the job. But nurse shortages are still common at Kaiser, said Douglas Aberg, a 17-year hospice nurse. NUHW is looking to write the standards into their contract, upping the leverage to enforce the ratios. The union is also pushing for guarantees that the hospital will add more staff when patients get sicker and won't compromise patient care by floating nurses into areas outside their expertise. Nurses were on the picket lines for 24 hours, starting at 6 a.m. on Wednesday and returning to work this morning, Thursday morning. Managers from other Kaiser facilities staffed the hospital along with some agency nurses, and the patient population dropped to one quarter of the usual 800 in anticipation of the strike. And it says here the new union is tested. This strike comes little more than a year after nurses at Los Angeles Medical Center left the much larger SEIU affiliate United Healthcare Workers West to join NUHW. The bitter contest between the two unions continues as NUHW is currently seeking a fresh election in Kaiser's largest bargaining unit of 45,000 service and technical workers. The new union argues that SEIU won last summer's contest because of widespread intimidation and heavy support for SEIU by the employer. Tom?
Last week, another group of U of I graduate students displayed their support for colleagues at the University of Wisconsin by delivering a large quantity of supplies to the graduate students who had gathered at the Wisconsin Capitol in Madison to try to retain their collective bargaining rights. According to Graduate Employee Organization co-president Stephanie Sewell, more than 40 U of I graduate students and their friends and family members traveled to Madison to show their support for the members of Wisconsin's Teaching Assistants Association. The Wisconsin students have been gathering at their state capitol to protest the passage of legislation in their state that would severely limit their bargaining rights. Sewell said that the Graduate Employee Organization members are concerned that limitations on bargaining rights in Wisconsin could very well have a domino effect and could negatively affect the preservation of those rights here in Illinois. The Illini graduate students delivered several boxes of supplies, including clean clothing, food, vitamin C tablets, and numerous other items donated here locally. Also, children of GEO workers made signs with union slogans and decorated cookies to give to the Wisconsin protesters. According to a spokesperson for the GEO, it was important for U of I students to show their support because members of the Wisconsin Teaching Assistants Association came to Champaign-Urbana last year to support the Illinois Graduate Students Union negotiations here at the U of I. Jason?
I appreciate you doing that story, Tom. As a member of GEO, we've been very actively involved in solidarity efforts locally and in Wisconsin, as the story shows, and in Springfield too, and have been holding solidarity vigil events at the YMCA continuously, really, for the last couple
people
weeks.
People are sticking together.
Absolutely, absolutely, and people realize full well just what this means and what this means for people in other states and just for public sector workers and workers in general. So, yeah, there's been an awful lot going on in GEO, I'm proud to say, and I've been involved in it too as far as with film series, but GEO has been seriously involved in solidarity efforts. This comes from the Bloomington Pantograph. Bloomington's Galaxy 14 Cinema is among four Illinois movie theaters that have been fined by the U.S. Labor Department for child labor violations. The theater, owned and operated by the St. Louis-based Werenberg Theaters chain, is accused of employing five minors to load and or operate a compactor and allowing two more to operate a motor vehicle. Werenberg's fine was levied as a corporate-wide penalty of $25,080 after an investigation between July 6, 2007 and September 11, 2009 involved were four of the 15 theater chain cinemas in three states. The resulting penalties were part of $277,475 in penalties assessed against three chains in nine states. In a statement from the Labor Department's Office of Public Affairs, the cited theaters are accused of allowing, quote, dozens of teens, end quote, to perform hazardous jobs and work longer hours than allowed by the youth employment provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was passed in 1938. Galaxy 14 violations involved the five miners loading and or operating a compactor and two a motor vehicle. An employee must be at least 18 to operate or unload a baler or compactor, as well as operate any motor vehicle as part of employment conditions. The other two chains fined were Knoxville, Tennessee-based Regal Cinemas Incorporated and Milwaukee, Wisconsin-based Marcus Theaters Corp. In Illinois, the theaters fined are Regal's Crystal Lake Showplace Stadium 16 in Crystal Lake, Marcus's Addison Cinema in Addison, and Marcus Gurney Cinema in Gurney. All told, the Labor Department said it found about 160 miners being required to perform hazardous jobs.
And by the way, the last union theater that existed in Champaign-Urbana was the one that used to be at Marketplace Mall out there. I don't even know if the building's there anymore. That the old Marketplace movie theater was the last union theater in Champaign. I'm not sure what happens at the Virginia Theater, though, when things go on there, if IATSE has anything in there or not with live shows or with the films.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you about Virginia either.
Yeah. But, yeah, it might be something to look into.
Yeah. Here's a story from great labor reporter Mike Elk, and it's regarding OSHA. Last month, Mike says he wrote how the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, seemed to be abandoning implementing key workplace safety rules. It appears that the abandonment of those rules might be an attempt to stall efforts by congressional Republicans to cut OSHA's budget. Republicans have been upset by tougher enforcement of OSHA standards under the Obama administration. They claim such enforcement is job-killing, while advocates claim tough OSHA enforcement prevents people that still actually have jobs from being killed. Big difference there. Congressional Republicans have proposed cutting $99 million from OSHA's budget this year, which would be drastic. Republicans have proposed a 20% cut, and given that half the year's over, that really means about a 40% cut, OSHA Administrator David Michaels told NPR. It would really have a devastating effect on all our activities. Republicans have been upset in particular by a set of ergonomic rules, the implementation of which OSHA announced earlier this week it was delaying or stopping, as many advocates claimed. This raises the questions of whether or not President Obama will fight to maintain the independence of agencies like OSHA so they can implement currently existing laws on the books. So far, it's unclear whether he will or not. Although in an indication of support for OSHA, President Obama did call for actually increasing their budget by 4% this year while posing a freeze on budgets of other agencies. And Mike Elk concludes, let's hope President Obama will defend OSHA as the budget battle heats up and stay on the side of workers.
According to a company official, seasonal layoffs at one of Rand Tool's largest employers have been lower this winter compared with last year. The Geldwin Window Manufacturing Plant in Rand Tool's Industrial Park had laid off 76 employees this winter, compared with 90 in the winter of 2009 and 10. Terry Klein, Director of Corporate Communications, said that most layoffs are on a temporary basis because the business is seasonal, and the layoffs are always with the intention of bringing laid-off employees back. The company already brought back seven employees during the month of February, which Klein said was unusual. The Rand Tool plant, which employs 379 people, is responsible for manufacturing made-to-order, energy-efficient wood-framed windows for customers throughout the country. She also said the plant will add two new customer service positions to its team of 14 representatives. Those positions will handle customer ordering for several other Geldwin locations in the United States. The Rand Tool plant is owned by Geldwin Incorporated, a privately held windows and doors company, and is a $2 billion a year business with 20,000 employees in 22 different countries and 26 U.S. states.
German commuters were warned of massive delays and cancellations across the country on Friday morning as train drivers walked off their jobs in a bid to pressure employers in an ongoing wage dispute. German train drivers union GDL called the three-hour strike for long-haul and regional train routes between 8:30 a.m. and 11:30 a.m. It was their third strike in 2 weeks. As with their strike last Friday, GDL leaders also chose to spare the already struggling S-Bahn commuter train services in Berlin, which have been operating on a limited schedule. Striking later in the day was a response to widespread anger by train passengers after the GDL's first strike last week, which prevented many from making it to work on time. That's funny. That seems to be what I think a strike is ought to do. The GDL union has demanded wage increases for some 26,000 regional, long-haul, and freight train drivers. They are hoping to get 105% of the current average wage at Deutsche Bahn. Many private train companies pay their drivers up to 30% less than Deutsche Bahn wage levels. The union has threatened to shut down the nation's railways if Deutsche Bahn and six other private train services fail to present an acceptable wage offer. On Friday, national rail provider Deutsche Bahn called for the GDL to end strikes and return to wage negotiations on Monday, a demand that GDL leader Klaus Weselski rejected. Friday's temporary strike was scheduled to be the last before the union counts member votes on Monday to decide whether to stage an indefinite strike. Bob?
Okay, I got a story here. Statistics released Friday this week. It says the private sector added 222,000 new jobs in February, but states and cities cut 30,000 jobs during the month, including 17,000 in education. If you go back a few years, you see the opposite pattern. Throughout 2008, as the private sector was cutting jobs, states and cities kept hiring. But over the past year, as the private sector has slowly started adding jobs, state and local governments have continued to cut month after month. The time lag between private and public sector job cuts makes sense if you think about city and state finances. In 2008, when private companies were cutting jobs, state and city budgets were still based on revenues from before the crisis took hold, so they were able to still hire people. But after the economy collapsed, tax revenues got hammered. State revenues fell by about 12% in 2009, it says. But anyway, more statistics. The unemployment rate sank to 8.9%, and that's the lowest since April of 2009. It says the rate has now fallen almost a full percentage point in just 3 months, and that's the sharpest drop in a generation. And hiring last month was broad among factories, trucking companies, healthcare providers, construction firms, hotels, and restaurants all added jobs. So,
happy days of here again.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was just thinking during the Geldwin story about the plant ran tool that makes the windows, that's a good indicator of things coming up, at least in the construction industry. Right. If Geldwin is getting more orders and having to hire more customer service people, including calling back more people in the plant.
That means they're getting more business.
Right. So maybe things are. I mean, I even got a day's work this week.
Excellent.
To pour some concrete at the U of I.
There was a story I was going to do a couple weeks ago, and I ran out of time, that said like Home Depot was hiring as many as like 50,000 temporary employees. This is the big time of the year for Home Depot coming up in spring. People are planting, doing things around the house and stuff, and
that's a lot of jobs.
That was a lot of jobs, but they're temporary, and I think a good percentage of them are part time
and non-union.
Yes.
Well, besides that, the guy that owns Home Depot is kind of notorious for saying that any business person or business that does not support Republicans is somehow out of their minds or something.
Really?
Yeah. It was okay. I wish I could remember the quote. It was really kind of funny.
Yeah.
So you're talking about enforcing a kind of groupthink among Republicans?
Among his employees, maybe?
Among his business colleagues, more or less.
I think we'll go to a cut from Workers Independent News. You can check them out every day at laborradio.org.
Oh, by the way, Doug Cunningham is on every Monday on the Tom Hartman Show, and you can hear that on WCPT AM 820 out of Chicago. If you're lucky, you can pick it up over the air if you have a good radio. If not, you can stream it. And Tom Hartman's on from 2 to 5. And that's just in case you don't care to listen to the World Beat Show here on WEFT.
Okay.
And before getting to this, I want to give a brief plug to Neil Parthen's Not Another Sports Show on WRFU, which is on Saturdays from 2 to 3. You can also get it. It's a podcast. You can get it online, and he's excellent, a sort of young, aspiring Dave Zirin type, fusing sports and politics. Very sharp guy.
And I believe he had a special guest appearance yesterday on the Smile Politely show here on WEFT on 5:30 on Friday evenings.
Yeah, sure did. He was great.
Yeah, I missed that, but I heard he was going to be on, so... All right, a little bit of Workers Independent News, and then I think we'll finish that off with a track from the Dropkick Murphys. They got a brand new song called Take 'Em Down, and it's from the band's new album, Going Out in Style, and it's in support of the Wisconsin Public Employee Union's fighting Governor Walker's attacks on collective bargaining.
Oh, by the way, Tom Hartman did play a cut by the Dropkick Murphys yesterday, and next week he is continuing only playing labor-oriented music on his program.
Excellent.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Wisconsin Senate Republicans passed a resolution Thursday calling on police to take state Senate Democrats into custody for contempt of the Senate. It's not an arrest warrant and doesn't come from a judge. The Wisconsin Democrats say they didn't flinch at the news and are staying put in Illinois in defense of collective bargaining for public workers. The Wisconsin Professional Police Association slammed the Republican action, saying using forcible detention of elected officials because they won't allow you to dictate with a free hand is an unreasonable abuse of police power and is insanely wrong. Dane County Judge John Albert said Thursday he'll issue an order saying the state of Wisconsin has closed the Capitol impermissibly, but ordering overnight protesters to be peacefully removed. The order lifts the access restrictions imposed by the state. Former State Attorney General Peg Lautenschlager, the lead attorney for the unions seeking a more open Capitol, said the state had restricted access to the point that people could not exercise their free speech and assembly rights. The Wisconsin Capitol remained locked down Thursday as a court hearing continued to win open public access again. Even as a reporter, I had a hard time getting in on Thursday. This is what getting in sounded like. Hi.
Hi.
Would you like to get into the building, please?
On the opposite side is the entrance.
There's only one entrance open?
The entrance is on the opposite side.
Could you explain to us why the judge's order is not being honored and all doors open to the public? I mean...
Gayla Olson of Black Earth, Wisconsin, describes what it was like once she managed to finally get into the Capitol building.
We had four police officers around us, okay? Four police officers, and then we had to be escorted by two police officers just to get out of the building. It was like a police state.
Everywhere you go in this Capitol now, police are here and the hallways are empty. Just about 100 protesters in the rotunda downstairs pounding on a drum. Police everywhere asking for IDs. This is not the people's house anymore in the Wisconsin tradition of how it normally is here. And people are gathered outside, hundreds of them, in the cold, and they are angry about this. And they are demanding to be let inside as they express their passionate disapproval of the lockdown of the people's house. Inside, about 100 demonstrators are still here who have been spending the night here. And right now there's a drum circle going on in the Capitol Rotunda here in Madison, keeping the drumbeat of this protest, this pro-worker protest, alive here in Madison, Wisconsin.
Democratic state lawmakers like Representative Fred Clark again set up their desks outside Thursday to protest the lockdown. Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News.
Calling. We can't let them win. Let them know. We gotta take the battle. us down. When the bus comes calling, gotta stand your ground. When the bus comes calling, don't believe their lies. When the bus comes calling, they'll take your soul. When the bus comes home, don't you sell your soul. When the bus comes calling, we gotta organize. Let them know, we gotta take the bastards down. Let them know, we gotta smash them to the ground. Let them know, we gotta take the bastards down. Let them know, we gotta take the bastards down. Let them know, we gotta smash them to the ground. Let them know, we gotta take the bastards down.
And that was the Dropkick Murphys with Take 'Em Down. And now we've reached that time of the program, the Illinois World Labor Hour Cultural Corner. And Tom's poem this week is March by the Millions from his book Cries for Justice.
All he wanted was a good job to buy his family their food and pay their rent and other bills and have some extra if he could. All he got was a pack of lies from the company he worked for. And when the truth he realized, the bosses kicked him out the door. Once he had had the warmth of a home that he could dwell in happily, until the greedy bankers came and dealt with him deceitfully. Now he is living in the street. His children cannot go to school. His aching heart is filled with tears from having been treated so cruel. He searches for work from Miami to New York and Chicago too, and Denver and Los Angeles, but just can't get on any crew. The government still bleeds him dry, although he lives by charity, and though tax time has come around, he knows he'll see no parity. He is numbered by the millions in our land of opportunity. He has had to learn the hard way that there is no immunity. If you are not already rich, the chances are you'll never be, unless we march by the millions and demand that justice we see. Justice in every workplace. Take from the rich and give to the poor. Socialize the American dream, or it won't be here anymore. March by the Millions was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on January 8, 2010, and was brought to you live today, March 5, 2011, on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Thanks, Tom.
Tune in to WEFT 90.1 FM next week, starting Monday, as various WEFT hosts honor Women's History Month, with different programs throughout the week featuring women artists, composers, and guests. Tuesday, March 8th, is the 100th anniversary of International Women's Day. You can find more information about events and issues around the world at internationalwomensday.com.
Okay, and also want to remind you, as usual, about the... you can watch Labor's View TV every Sunday, 4 o'clock, on Cable Channel 6. And that is hosted by our own David Johnson, who's not here today, but is usually here on most Saturdays. And also friend of the show, Jim Iman. That's 4 o'clock on Sunday, Cable Channel 6. And I think Bill had some comments.
Yeah, I just want to remind people, I think that we don't promote other WFT shows often enough. We need to make a note of that. And I just had a thought. I often enjoy the Prairie Monk program on Sundays at 11, I believe. And Dave's very, even though he's from Australia, he's incredibly steeped in the history of Central Illinois.
Yes, he is.
And just, yeah. It's amazing what they talk about. Bill Saylor, I like listening to him. And, those guys do a pretty good show, and they've done it for, God, I don't know how long here.
Quite a few years.
Yes, yeah. Very much.
We also commented last few weeks about Lori Serb's program on Friday mornings. Dog is my co-pilot.
Oh,
She often plays labor radio on that show as well.
That's right.
Workers Independent News.
A lot of good Zydeco.
Yeah. Yeah, she played a great show yesterday with all kind of Mardi Gras music and stuff. So.
Yeah, Lori's great. I've known her for a long time and just love her to death.
Excellent. And I guess we're going to go to a little bit of Hightower Radio, if somebody gets around to playing with the CD player here.
Mm-hmm. The old technology.
The old technology. Bill, did you have something lined up there that you wanted to play off of your computer?
Oh, not right at the moment, but
a little bit later.
I got some computerish types of things to discuss. Maybe what people might want to look at.
Yeah. Well, we'll get into Hightower news here. He's got a story called "Plenty of American Jobs."
And by the way, you can friend Jim Hightower too.
America is still an exporting powerhouse. In fact, our corporate chieftains have made us number one in exporting America's most precious goods: our jobs, factories, technologies, and middle-class opportunities. With unemployment and underemployment devastating millions of families in our country, perhaps you've assumed that U.S. corporations aren't hiring these days. Nonsense. They added 1.4 million jobs last year alone, overseas. For example, more than half of Caterpillar's new hires in 2010 were in foreign countries. Many more of this giant's jobs are headed offshore in the near future, for Caterpillar, which was once an iconic American brand, has recently invested in three new plants in China. It'll not only manufacture tractors and bulldozers there, but it'll also begin to ship its design work and technology development jobs to China. Likewise, DuPont, once proud of its U.S. workforce, has slashed its number of American employees in recent years while increasing its Asia-Pacific workforce by more than half. Indeed, DuPont no longer considers itself American. We're a global player, sniffs its chief innovation officer. Such homemade brands as Coca-Cola, Dell, and IBM are also among the multitude of corporations abandoning our shores and our middle class. Of course, they still keep their well-appointed headquarters here so the corporation and top executives can continue enjoying all that America has to offer. Calvin Coolidge once asserted that what's good for business is good for America. That was myopic enough, but today's narcissistic CEOs are even more self-serving, declaring that what's good for business is good for business. America be damned. This is Jim Hightower saying, if we're to have a united society, America cannot tolerate such raw selfishness by the privileged few. We can have a plutocracy or a democracy, but not both.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Okay, and a quick track here from Frank Zappa and sexual harassment in the workplace. This used to be one of Bill's favorites. So.
Yeah, it's instrumental, so you don't
have to worry about the lyrics. So.
Yeah.
It's a nice, greasy one.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
that was Frank Zappa with sexual harassment in the workplace. And as Jason mentioned earlier, this is Women's History Month, and the event traces its beginnings back to the first International Women's Day. That was in 1911, so this would be the 100th anniversary, I guess. And International Women's Day was originally called International Working Women's Day. It's marked on the 8th of March every year as a major day of global celebration of women in different regions. The focus of the celebration ranges from general celebration of respect, appreciation, and love towards women to a celebration of women's economic, political, and social achievements. It was started as a socialist political event, and the holiday blended in the culture of many countries, primarily Eastern Europe, Russia, and the former Soviet bloc. In many regions, the day lost its political flavor. However, in some regions, the original political and human rights theme designated by the United Nations runs strong, and political and social awareness of the struggles of women worldwide are brought out and examined in a hopeful manner. The first International Women's Day was observed 19th of March 1911 in Germany, followed by a declaration by the Socialist Party of America. The idea of having an International Women's Day was first put forward at the turn of the 20th century amid rapid world industrialization and economic expansion that led to protests over working conditions. In 1910, the Second International held the first International Women's Conference in Copenhagen, and it was suggested by the important German socialist Clara Zetkin. Although no date was specified, it did occur the following year in 1911. And it was marked by over a million people in Austria, Denmark, Germany, and Switzerland. In the West, International Women's Day was first observed as a popular event after 1977, when the United Nations General Assembly invited member states to proclaim March 8th as the UN Day for Women's Rights and International Peace. So, anyway, that's what we're celebrating somewhat this month.
Yeah, we'll have plenty of things throughout the month. Rank-and-file workers, various labor leaders who have been women, and also certainly significant events. This is the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire coming up this month as well. So
yes, it was.
Plenty of significant positive and unfortunately negative things to discuss that have involved and at various times impacted women especially.
There was an interesting story on PBS this week on Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, about the strikes that went on there and in the garment industry in New York. And, you know, that was months before the fire and everything.
That's right. But the year before was what when they had big strikes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And how brave those women were to stand up against these people. That at the same thing as going on now. These private enterprises just did not want unions in their factories.
Yeah.
They'd do anything to keep them out. They hired thugs to beat up the women on the street and stuff like that, you know. Just ridiculous.
Absolutely. And women so often fought back, and literally fought back.
Bravely, yes.
Yeah, really. They were not afraid to be physically involved and, if need be, to duke it out. And look at some of the circumstances they faced, too. And we'll talk more about Triangle in the coming weeks. But and look at how the more things changed, the more they stayed the same. I mean, so many
right.
people died because they were locked in to this factory. And look at this is right. the same stuff that smaller sweatshops in various cities that Walmart does. I mean,
right. We report on this in some of these factories in Thailand and stuff when there's fires, and that's the same exact thing that went on, you know, 100 years ago, basically. They've got these workers locked into these factories.
Yeah. Common greed and repression in the form of industrialization.
Right. Jason had a good story back at the beginning of the year. We talked about the 1937 sit-down strike in Flint, Michigan, and we reported then about how active the women were involved in that whole strike and in the planning and everything that they did up there to support the workers. And
well, also, if you would watch the movie, actually, there are two movies about this. One was a documentary made at the time, and that is called Harlan County, USA. The second one was a Showtime, fictionalized version of it, produced several years ago. I can't remember exactly when, starring Holly Hunter, as a matter of fact.
Right. Yeah.
And which actually followed the original documentary very closely. You could tell they studied the documentary, and even in the way they just framed the shots. But what happens quite often is that one of the reasons when you go by somewhere and there's a picket and you only see like three
people standing there, is that there will be a court injunction that limits the number of pickets to 3 people per gate. Now, of course, back in the old days, and especially with the coal mines, and this was in the early 1970s, a coal strike in Harlan County, Kentucky, there was such a court injunction made. Well, since that was a very ineffective picket and in no way at all would intimidate the scabs coming in, they realized there is no injunction against people that are not striking minors, which was mainly the women of the community.
Right.
And it's an amazing movie. Barbara Kopple, the producer-director, did a really excellent job of these women who came out every day and braved much danger. I mean, there's scenes where they come out and they have baseball bats and attack the scabs. There's one scene at night, you can't see anything except for the flashes and you hear the gunshots coming from inside the mine at them. And Florence Reese is featured in it, and she sings her song that she wrote in the 1920s during a strike there when it was called Bloody Harlan County. And it's called the famous song, Which Side Are You On? And she sings it at a meeting of the United Mine Workers, and it's just incredible.
Yeah, that's a great movie, and I think you're putting your finger on so much important about that, Bill, especially the role of women. I mean, they were engaging in civil disobedience, blocking cars and the roads and planning, and had gotten that tactic. That had occurred and had been shown in a different movie, Salt of the Earth, where that was exactly the tactic that it was. The film came out in 1954, but was portraying copper miners in the Southwest who had done exactly
Mexican American
copper
miners. As a matter of fact,
that's exactly right. Largely Mexican Americans, and they did the same thing. This is a restrictive injunction, especially in relation to the Taft-Hartley Act, restricted miners, not women, and it was women who helped carry the day big time in that thing. And it's exactly the sort of historical parallel, and probably not an accident, especially I think in these mining communities that are fairly isolated but also pretty closely knit, and where there are particular gender roles oftentimes, but where when women are involved, they often make a pivotal difference in these events.
Right, and that film there is a wonderful example of kind of underground filmmaking. It was not a documentary.
Right.
It was a feature film that was produced by a bunch of left-wingers just right after that strike, as a matter of fact, I believe.
It was within 3 years and was much delayed in good part because of the repression within the film industry, but also of unions of putting it out. Mm-hmm. It actually had to be made in sections in secret and moved around because of basically the repression of this mine mill. Yeah.
And parts of it were made in Mexico, I believe. One of the actresses. See, many of the people who were in the film were the actual miners.
That's right. Juan Chacon, and he was one example. He was a miner.
And one of the actresses, I believe, I'm real sketchy on this. I haven't read about it for quite some time. Was not allowed back into the United States or something, so they had to shoot some of it in Mexico. And for those of you who like the old show The Waltons, Grandpa Walton stars in this, and he's an old lefty, folks.
That's right, Will Gear.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the actress was Rosaura Revueltas. She was
Yes.
That's right.
Well, why don't we listen to a friend of the show, Ann Feeney, doing Which Side Are You On?
Yes. Right. One of my favorite songs, man. It's a wonderful sort of this Appalachian great song, almost a high lonesome sound.
Yeah. Okay.
Come all of you good workers, this news to you I'll tell. The rights we take for granted now, we have no right to sell. Does anyone remember the days with full John L? It's thanks to him no child of mine will know the breaker's hell. Tell me, which side are you on?
Which side? side are you on?
Which 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 side are you on? From the world of suits and ties, they preach cooperation. Don't listen to their lies. Your parents bled and starved to claim your right to organize. Which side are you on?
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 Which side are you on? Let's remember where we come from, and our union cannot fail. Remember who we are, my friends, and I know we will prevail. The fire has been rekindled, and Pittston tells the tale. Our lives are ours and ours alone, and the future's not for sale. Tell me, which side are you on?
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 Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
Which side are you on?
And we're back. That was Ann Feeney doing Which Side Are You On? And I think Bill had some comments coming in on Facebook.
Well, actually, I do want to say hi to my very dear friend Linda in Michigan. And I hope she's listening. And somebody who is listening, a more local person, old Kendall. And he says he's been listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour, which suggests that the would you suggest that this show is not slanted towards the, quote, liberal view? Yes, I would suggest that because do you have Love Me, I'm a Liberal?
Yeah, we do.
Okay, we'll go out of the show on that, Kendall. Listen to that song very closely. It's by the great Phil Oakes. And we are actually insulted if you call us liberals. Because to us, a liberal is a reformist capitalist that we don't want to have anything to do with. And they lay down, and at best, they're kind of fellow travelers, but they don't go anywhere near far enough down the path with us, you know. They'll have to go into the re-education camps with you, Kendall, when the revolution happens. And speaking of the revolution, there's quite a bit of talk recently on general strikes.
Yes.
And one thing, my good friend Terry Lee has a Facebook page called A Call for General Strike. And beyond that, there's another Call for General Strike Facebook page, but that's in July 2011. And the thing is about the general strikes, this kind of started with the Southern Wisconsin labor unions. It started talking about it. And one of the problems with a general strike is, you know, everybody goes on strike, or at least an appreciable number of people go on strike to shut everything down. Well, when you look at the United States of America, which has approximately 350 million residents, and I would say probably 150 to 200 million of those people probably work somewhere, you're talking about a really huge undertaking. And one of the big problems when I've seen these calls, which pop up periodically, especially if you listen to, quote, liberal talk radio, you'll hear people call in and talk about it. And I remember a few years ago during the Bush administration, there was an organization called the World Can't Wait, which was calling for a general strike. Well, the thing is, and they were, and people, they'll call for one like next month. Well, it's not going to happen. Number one, for one thing, you're not going to get the actual labor unions behind it. The last thing the people that run these unions want is for you to feel like you have any power and for you to feel like that the union is you, because they want to make sure that they've got their cushy, big-paying jobs and their perks and they're inside the Washington, D.C. Beltway marble palaces, as the Teamsters refer to their headquarters in Washington, D.C., and they want to play golf with Barack Obama and hang out with the senators and blah, 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 and the enemy and everybody else. So they're not likely to call for a general strike, especially when there's Democrats in control of things. Number two, on this call for a general strike page on Facebook, we were discussing through chat a lot of things, and people are getting into stuff like, oh, well, we want to talk about revolution and abolition of the wage system. Well, I'm going to tell you right now, man, you walk on a construction job and you start talking to the brothers and sisters on that job about abolishing the wage system, and the first thing they're going to be wondering is, well, how am I going to pay for my Harley and my pickup truck and my boat? All right. There's no way you can, you know, it's just impossible. These things are going to take a lot of groundwork, and it's not going to be talking about it on Facebook. It's not going to be through websites. It's not going to be liberal talk radio. It's not going to be WEFT. What it's going to be is people getting together on a local